Hi, my name is Janice Del Campo, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Janice.
Oh, my. My heart is racing so hard that we are either going to have the greatest talk in the world or I'm going to pass out. You know, and somebody just, Karen turned to me and said, would you like a cup of coffee? I said, are you kidding? I want to thank you all for inviting me to come here. I am Alex's lesson in love, tolerance, and patience. If he's in the room, he kept trying to reach me, and I don't always return my calls in 24 hours. And he was so efficient getting everything done, and I don't think he was really sure whether or not I was even going to show up. So I called him a few days before I left, and I said, Alex, left him a message on his tape recorder. I said, I just thought I'd let you know I'm coming. So he could relax. Okay, I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. What I was asking, do we have like an hour or 45 minutes?
Hour.
Hour, thanks. Don't say that. And between 45 minutes and an hour can determine how fast I'm going to talk. You've had some fast talkers here this weekend. The speakers have just been phenomenal. Don't you think you've enjoyed them? I have just met Karen, had not met her before, and Jack and Janet and I know each other, but we can't remember from where, so that doesn't tell us we get perfectly better here. And I said to somebody outside, I've been with Bobby somewhere before, and they went, that sounds really weird. So, but anyway, and what I do is I'm just going to kind of visit with you a minute till I figure out if God's going to work through me or not, and if he's not, we get to go home early and I get to catch an earlier flight. My hostess, Karen, has been a delight. If you don't know her and you're from this area, you should get to know her. She's just as sweet as she can be. And she's been very kind and just took really good care of me, and I appreciate it. We went out to dinner last night, and I had a steak. Oh, my God. It was so good. I had to be really careful not to lick the plate, you know? And I kept thinking, eat calmly, eat slowly, but it was the best. And so thanks for a little Kansas beef. It was great. I mean, it actually gives me energy. You know, I like beef occasionally. And it'll frighten you to think I need more energy. My friend Pat picked me up at the airport. I knew him from my home group in Denver. And it was just great to catch up with him and to remember times gone by and that sort of stuff. And so good to see him and his wife, Jan. But my home group is the Happy Way Group in Denver, Colorado. We have 9 meetings a week. And we're at 3159 South Broadway, and if you're in Denver, I expect you to come see us. We're a really neat group, and I've got to warn you about some stuff up front about me, so some of you can leave if you want. But are there any Al-Anons out in the audience? Get it up high. It's okay. Oh, yes, 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 yes. Good for you. I love Al-Anons. I do. And because I love them so much, I'm going to tell a little joke. And it's a good Al-Anon joke, and if I continue speaking, I'm going to have to come up with another joke, but this one is just so good. And do you know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? None. They just detach and let it screw itself. That's spiritual for Sunday morning, right? And if there are any alcoholics who didn't understand that joke, you will. So anyway, I've got to warn you, I'm a big book thumping kind of gal. I really am. I come from a long lineage of sponsorship out of the first 164 pages, and I include the doctor's opinion, which used to be page 1, and it is no longer. And so I include all of that, and that's how I was raised, and so that's probably what you're going to hear about today. It's billed as a spiritual meeting, and I kind of snickered to myself. People who know me well went, they put Janice on Sunday morning? Oh, my. So I started thinking about that spiritual stuff, right? What is that spiritual stuff? What is spirit? Spirit is joyful. Spirit is light. In my sobriety, when I'm not laughing, there's a problem. Okay? So spiritual is light. And I used to think that spiritual was everything I'm not. You know, I'm outspoken. I'm a little bit loud, you know, and I'm very direct and I'm a little bit hard on people. I really appreciated something Bobby said last night about working with other people. I've been known to hit them with a big book or kick them out of my house. you know, if they didn't want to pay attention and do it the way I said. And because it's real important to me. I am still probably as passionate about my sobriety as I was 20 years ago. And the reason is it works, and I'm a consistent worker of the steps, not because I'm a good person, but because I'm a real alcoholic. And so, and I know it works. It's worked in my life, it's worked in other people's lives, and so I get pretty excited about this process here. And one of the things I like to talk about, I want to tell you how very much I appreciate your statement here about if you have a problem other than alcohol, there's an anonymous program for you. I thought that was a great statement. And the reason I say that is that I came here through another fellowship because I thought I was something else. And I thought actually I was a drug addict. And I found out by being with a person who was an alcoholic, properly armed with facts about himself, that I'm not. I am an alcoholic. And the reason I talk about that a lot is because it's really important for us to know what we are. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about my background. And I watched in the sobriety countdown, you know, we've got the, there is somebody here with 46 years, which is really neat, people in their 30s and their 20s and all that. And you see this gap in time, you know, and then you get to 5 years and there's a ton of them and a million at one. Okay, my whole purpose being up here, there could be 10,000 people in the audience or 22. My job up here is to reach one person. If you hear me and you hear my message, there's hope for you if you're a real alcoholic like I am, because there is a way out of that. The reason that I have the sponsor that I have today is because I heard this person say from the podium once, you never ever have to drink alcohol again and you never have to feel the way you're feeling right now. And I believed him. And so I went after that, and I too have a male sponsor. You know, I'm kind of mean, and so, and I had to pay attention. But anyway, I love my sponsor. The other thing is, you're going to hear a lot of things from me that are not original. I'm going to talk about my sponsor and my teachers. You see, because when I have an original thought, it's frightening. Right? Anytime somebody says, gosh, I've got a great idea, you go, well, you might want to, like, put it aside and pray about it instead. So anyway, I'm full of a lot of stuff you guys have taught me. What I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about my drinking, and I'm going to ask you to come with me on your personal journey while I do this and see if any of the stuff that I talk about sounds familiar. Now, our backgrounds may not be familiar, and how I was raised may not be like you, but what I'm talking about is alcohol, because I do not believe that my past made me an alcoholic. I believe that what the doctor's opinion says is that I experience a phenomenon of craving, and that's something that my sister-in-law does not experience. She has a drink or two of wine, and she doesn't like how she feels. Well, that's the feeling that I'm looking for all the time. You know, she has a couple glasses of wine, and she just says, I just can't stand this. And I'm like, well, we will never drink together. She once had surgery, and they gave her some Valium, and she called me because it upset her so much how it made her feel. I said, well, honey, mail that bottle right on up here. I understand that feeling, and I can handle it. So come with me on this little journey, think about your drinking, and maybe you too are a real alcoholic. And I may say some things that are controversial. AA is not full of alcoholics. And that's a fact. We get people from all different walks of life, and that's okay. And some are alcoholic and some aren't. So if you and I don't relate, it's a pretty good chance that you maybe aren't alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, and that's okay. But who I work with and who I talk to, it says that one alcoholic can best help another alcoholic. When you talk about language of the heart, what is language of the heart? It's you and me sitting down across my kitchen table talking about this and finding a way out, which is in that book. So, I had my first drink when I was 15 years old. Oh, my God. I was at my sister's wedding. It was the dinner afterwards, and I tell people I can remember it like it happened yesterday. It's just as clear as a bell. I remember what I was wearing, who I was sitting with. I was with my brother and his girlfriend, Judy. And the restaurant we were in, and it had, we were sort of in the bar area, and you know those little wire-back chairs, you know? So those little heart-shaped wire-back chairs sitting there, being prim and proper. I was raised to be prim and proper. Something went wrong. And terribly, as you'll hear, but it was interesting. And so my brother went to go get me a drink. And when he came back, he had one of those, like, highball glass, you know, a drink glass, and it was sort of cloudy looking. You know those cloudy drinks with that stuff in it. And he gave it to me. And I can remember seeing all of it. And I took that drink, and I remember drinking it like this, and all of a sudden it hit about right here, and I went, whew, whoa. You know, and I had a spiritual experience. I truly was a spiritual experience. You know why? My life was altered on the spot. My life was changed. Now, what it did was it made me feel okay. The funny thing was I wasn't real sure that I didn't feel okay before. But whatever it did, it solved my problem. It was a spiritual experience. Now, did I feel like a regular kid? No, I didn't. You know, but I didn't think about that a lot. I was the kind of kid, I remember I was coming home from school one day, I was 8 years old, I was going to a Catholic girls' school up the street. We had just bought a new house, and I was walking home, and I remember thinking my family would have moved and not told me where they went. Okay, so we're not talking about a well-balanced child here before she took her first drink. And I was also raised in a little bit of a war zone, which we'll talk about. But anyway, that first drink altered my life. It altered my perception. It made me feel better, and I felt like I had found a solution. It took me 15 more years to find this solution. So I did at that party what any good budding alcoholic does. I had that first drink, and then what did I do? I said, I want another one of those. Well, they should have known right then we were in for the long haul, because I tried to pick up the priest that night, and he was really a really cute little Irish guy. And my mom's Irish. That's where, of course, I get the alcoholism. My father was Italian, and of course, that's where I get my cooking, and that I quit doing. But anyway, I was singing him Irish love songs, you know, and you know when Irish eyes are smiling and leaning over and flirting, and my family just didn't get it, you know, I guess, because nobody stopped me. But anyway, it was the beginning of a long, long haul. I was raised in El Paso, Texas. Any of you ever been there? Yeah, it's on the border with Juarez, Mexico. And they don't card you in Juarez, so I started drinking in Juarez, Mexico. And you could drink about, like, mixed drinks back then were 35 cents a piece, so a $5 bill went a long way. And that's what I did all through high school, was I'd go over on weekends and drink in Juarez. And I never drank moderately. And I always remember thinking I was going to drink like a lady. I never found that out. If some of you know what that is, you can tell me later. But, so I thought it was the kind of drinks I drank. So I would drink daiquiris, things like that, and you know, things that were sweet and had cherries in them and all that kind of thing, because I thought that was drinking like a lady. And I remember I came home one night and I was really sick, throwing up, and I remember my mom said to me, well, what are you drinking? And I said, well, you know, bourbon and seven daiquiris. And she said, oh, no, 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 that's the problem. She said, you need to learn to drink scotch, because that sweet stuff will make you sick. Right? It's the sweet stuff that's making me sick. My mother, God bless her, was an alcoholic. And I didn't find that out until I got sober. I didn't understand. See, I thought that we just did a lot of entertaining. We did. A lot of people came over and we were entertaining. You know, my whole family was entertaining. Big parties, a lot of wine, a lot of liquor, the liquor flowed. I mean, that's what you did. And I didn't understand that not everybody's mother, you know, popped the top on a country club malt liquor at 11 o'clock in the morning. It just didn't occur to me. We didn't understand that. That was just de rigueur. And so I thought I was doing what my family did when I was drinking. My mother died at the ripe old age of 47 years old on the living room floor. It was a combination of alcohol and drug abuse. I had a brother who was killed in a car wreck when I was about 13. And my dad was a pediatrician, and his best friend was a psychiatrist. And my family didn't deal well with it. We didn't really have a spiritual foundation. The priests liked to come over and visit with us and have dinner and stuff. But there really wasn't that foundation, evidently, for us, pardon me, to survive what was coming ahead. So my brother was about 15, and the way they helped us handle all this stuff was that they gave us medications. And I was put on Stelazine, Elavil, and Dalmane when I was about 13 or 14, and my mom was put on Seconals. I'm going to talk about drugs here out of necessity because I come from the culture of drugs, and the reason I'm going to talk about them is because I'm not a drug addict. And I'll show you how I found that out. But anyway, my mom used to take a lot of these Seconals because she was really a very unhappy lady. And anyway, it ended up killing her about 5 years later. So, and today, you know, I remember I was at a meeting at York Street. Some of you have been fortunate enough to go to York Street? Yeah? Where's my darn thing? Anyway, is there a cough drop over there? No? Okay, it's okay. Anyway, I'll get through it. At York Street, I remember there was a woman there celebrating her birthday. And she was there with her daughter. The mom had like 15 years and the daughter had 3 years. And I thought, that could have been me. That could have been me and my mom, you know. Thank you, love. That could have been me and my mom. And it just didn't happen. Now, I'm not going to give you some big sob story. These are just facts out of my past. And some of you have been there and some of you haven't. In the meantime, I'm just drinking all the time. The first thing we did when my brother died was we went to the liquor store. I remember going to the liquor store with this lady, Meredith Durkel, you know, and she was in her nightgown, and she had a full-length fur coat over it in El Paso, Texas, so you know what a bonehead she was. I remember walking around and going to the liquor store early in the morning, picking up cases of liquor because the relatives were coming in because my brother died. You know, you drink in the hearse, you drink in here, and everybody's drinking. You know, that's what you did. My mom's funeral came, you just drink, drink, drink. And then a few years later, my dad died, and you just drink, drink, drink. That's what you do. And I kept drinking. The thing about me was I never ever went out. Did you ever say I'm going to go out and have a drink? I don't think I ever did that in my entire life. And I sponsor people and say, well, you know, I couldn't have just one. And they say, well, I did that once. Really? How long have you been drinking? 15 years. And once you had one drink, okay. We might be in a little bit of denial, but it's cool. We'll work through it. you know? So, anyway, I remember when I had my first drug that helped everything. I was about 18 years old. I was working at the time because I left home shortly after my mother died. And my father and I didn't get along. And I was at this radio station. I wasn't feeling very good because I was hungover. And this disc jockey came up to me and he says, boy, you look terrible. And I said, well, I feel terrible. And he says, well, I'm going to give you something here that'll make you feel better. Well, I like feeling better. Remember that spiritual experience with Tom Collins. So he gave me this little green capsule. And I remember taking that, and you know what? I had another spiritual experience. The most remarkable thing happened. My hangover went away. Any of you have ever taken amphetamines? No, I like to call them diet pills because amphetamines sound like people that are, you know, on the streets or something. So, and I'm a doctor's kid, so I take diet pills. I don't take speed. I'm a lady. We take diet pills. I was a little overweight at the time. Made sense. But the neat thing about speed, for any of you who have done it, is that, oh, my God, can you drink some liquor? Right? And keep your head clear. I was a great date, you know, drive everybody home. And I could shoot a great game of pool. People used to bet on me. I could just, you know, see everything and shoot really fast. Couldn't miss. And I was a great worker bee because I didn't stay home with a hangover. I could get up in the morning, take a little speed, get to work. You work very fast on this stuff. Can't remember where you put anything. But your house is clean. That goes away, by the way, in sobriety. But I was a toothbrush cleaner, you know. And I truly thought I was the greatest date in town. I love country western bars. I love cowboys, you guys. I've been checking out your boots. See, what I do is I look at the boots and then I look up. You know, I was like, oh, get a grip. But I loved cowboys. And I love that cowboy music. It's the best drinking music in the whole world. And I have a friend who called me the other day at 4 o'clock in the morning. He's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And he had some problems going on and he started taking pain medication. Okay, he started taking narcotics. And now he's addicted to narcotics. He called me at 4 in the morning and we talked a little later. We were visiting about it and I said, you know what, it's almost good enough for the name of a song. It's 4 in the morning. I said, the unfortunate thing is somebody already wrote it. You know, but when people call you at 4 in the morning, they're in trouble. You know, and this friend of mine is facing a lot of stuff and thinking it's no big deal because he didn't drink alcohol. You know, and so I'm a believer in we don't smoke dope on Sunday. Okay? AA stands for absolute abstinence in my book. You know, you can't be smoking dope on Sunday going, oh, well, that's cool. You know, it's not alcohol. And I've talked to people who do that, and they go, well, I needed to take the edge off. And I go, if anybody needs to take the edge off, it's me, okay? And I don't get to do that. That's not in my program. So anyway, I'm doing the speed, and then that psychiatrist, I hung on to him because he was a good guy to have around, and he would give me an open prescription for Valium because I needed to take the edge off. And so this is what I used to do for 10 years. I'd get up in the morning with a hangover, I'd take some of those amphetamines, some of those diet pills, go to work really hard, say to the girls, let's go to the bar for a few drinks. We'd go to the bar for a few drinks, I'd start drinking, that phenomenon of craving would kick in. Next thing I'd know, I'd want more liquor, and I'd think, I'm coming down from the amphetamines. So I'd have to take some more speed so I could stay up and shoot pool and dance on the tables and dance with the cowboys. Then the bar closes at 2 in the morning, and I'm high as a kite, so I got to take some Valium so I can go to sleep. And that's what I did for 10 years, just to control what I was doing. I came here thinking I was a drug addict, and I'm not. I'm not a drug addict. I'm a woman who takes drugs so I can drink more alcohol. That's what I am. And the reason I'm very clear about talking about that, if you don't know what you are, you need to find out what you are. Because if you're saying you're a this and you're really a this, you may not have a spiritual experience in those steps. It's promised. It says we cannot have a spiritual experience if we're living a lie. And I had to know what the truth was. And the reason I know about my alcoholism is because, I'll give you an example. Near the end of my drinking, a friend of mine called on a Sunday and said, let's go over to this bar. It's called the Oak Alley. Shoot a game of pool and have a couple drinks or something. And the first thought in my mind was, what do I have to do for work on Monday? The reason that was the first thought in my mind was, I'm an alcoholic. See, I knew somewhere deep inside that once I got there, there might be one game of pool, but there was never going to be just two drinks. I knew somewhere deep inside I was going to be there till that place closed. And since on Sunday it closed early, I had to be sure I had liquor in the house. Or I had to be sure that I had diet pills because I knew I'd be so hungover on Monday, I either wouldn't make it to work, or if I did, I was going to need a lot of drugs to get there. That's alcoholism. Alcoholism is not being able to predict my behavior once I begin to drink. Alcoholism is not my consequences. My consequences have come as a result of my alcoholism. I know where my car is today, you guys, okay? Okay, and I do not run into parked cars today. I just don't do it. I don't have to worry about leaving the scene of an accident. I don't have to worry about grabbing my stuff out of my car so the police can't identify me through my stuff in the car. But if I never drank, those things don't happen. My problem is that when I put liquor in my body, something kicks in. I've got that little mechanism that's referred to in the doctor's opinion as a phenomenon of craving. Once it kicks in and I want more alcohol. And there are people where that doesn't happen to them. And that's why when you're sitting there talking with somebody or your family member's looking at you saying, why do you do that? And we can't even explain it because we don't know. Because I'm physically and mentally different. The physical difference is that I love alcohol once it kicks in. And I'm going to drink more alcohol. It doesn't matter. And this is really important. There's this guy I really liked. He was a drug dealer. It made life good. And we used to keep money in the freezer, you know, and the guns and stuff. It was great. And very exciting. And how I adored him, though. Handsome, good-looking guy from East Texas, ostrich boots. And just, you know, the leather jackets. And, I mean, just stunning. And I used to say to him, honey, I'm going to be home by 7. And I meant it. I worked at the phone company. Here I was, a straight-laced lady, you know, living with a drug dealer. But anyway, living out my fantasies. But and I would say, you know, Tony, I'm going to be home by 7. I was going to leave work, stop with the girls, have a couple of drinks, happy hour, right? No big deal. They only give you 2 at a time, you know, and I'll be home. And I meant it with every fiber of my being, and so did you. I'll be home at 7 for dinner. I was probably supposed to cook. And the weirdest thing would happen. I'd start drinking, and I didn't even know it, but 7 o'clock passed. And the phone would ring at the bar, and somebody would come over and say, Janice, Tony's on the phone. I'm like, ah, damn. You know, what time is it? You know, 8:30 or something? Well, I'll be home by 10. And I meant that one, too. Why don't you go pick up a Taco Bell or something? You know, but I'll be home at 10. And 10 came and 10 passed, and I never got home. I couldn't get home. Not because I didn't love him, not because I didn't care, not because I wasn't hungry, but because a phenomenon of craving had kicked in my body and nothing was going to stop me from drinking. Nothing. We look at each other. Didn't you love Nancy Reagan? God love her. Just say no. Huh? That's right up our alley, isn't it? No. I know she meant well. You know what I mean? But just say no. And we would laugh about it in meetings. Oh, just say no. It'll be okay. No? God love her. God love us. God love the Al-Anons who've had to put up with it. You know, if you haven't, you ought to try out an Al-Anon meeting sometime. You know, we sit here and laugh about the stuff we did, and we think we're so funny. And it is. It's humorous, and we get light about it. And, you know, I mean, how many places can you go? We talk about suicide, and everybody rolls on the floor laughing, you know? And I had a crisis this morning. I could not find the lid for my hair stuff, you know, and I'm like, I'm having a crisis. And that's the kind of thing we go, oh, my God, I ought to shoot myself. I have a run in my stocking, and I'm going to give a talk. You know, and we laugh. But until you've heard the pain in an Al-Anon's heart about the stuff that we think is funny, okay, you get a little bit different perspective about what our behavior was really like for other people. So it's kind of interesting to do that. Anyway, I made my way here. I'll tell you quickly. I raised in El Paso, saw Denver, fell in love with it. They had those mountain men, you know, in the plaid shirts. And Beards, and it was like great, and Rocky Mountain High, and I thought, my problem is I've been living in the wrong city, and if I would get to Denver, I could ride a bicycle and wear braids and plaid flannel shirts, and I too will be healthy, okay? And, you know, that's how they are up there. They rock climb, you know, and they do all that stuff, and, you know, they ski and snowboard and run into trees, and so I'm thinking, I'm going to do this. So I got up there, and needless to say, it lasted about 2 weeks. I ended up in a bar up in Bergen Park above Evergreen, drinking, raising hell, looking for cowboys. And the next thing I knew, I needed drugs to keep drinking because I couldn't drink the amount I wanted to drink without passing out. So I wrote a letter to a pharmacist in El Paso, and he mailed me my drugs. So I ended up in Denver. I'm a smooth-talking son of a gun. Okay, anyway, so that's how I drank. Did you drink like that? You know, could you go to a bar and stop? You know, that's alcoholism. Now, if you don't have that experience, you may not be an alcoholic. And if you're not, you may not have the experience that some people have here working the steps because you haven't got our problem. It doesn't mean the steps don't work for people, but you got to know what the problem is in order to work the steps. If I don't know what I'm powerless over, why do I even need a power greater than myself to solve the problem? If I still think I've got some power, whether it's over drinking or whatever that is, for me, over drinking, I don't belong here. And I'll tell you right now, if I could drink successfully and still date cowboys, I would not be here on a Sunday morning. That's fact. You know, and they talk about giving you a drug that will stop the high. Why bother? Do you know, I mean, what a horrible feeling that would be to get that drink, you know, and then get that pill and take a drink and you sit there and go, well, what's this all about? Right? I'm looking for that sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking just a few drinks. Because I'm a restless, irritable, and discontented kind of gal. Well, the good news is I found this fellowship. And I found this program, and I did go through another fellowship. And in about 5 years, I was like this, you know. I wasn't feeling very good. You know, I felt like my skin was coming off, and I didn't know what to do with it, and I was just going crazy. And I heard somebody speak one night, and they carried a great message. And they talked about that book, which I had been raised on, in that fellowship, because there wasn't any other literature at that time. But I heard totally different stuff in that from that person talking about that book than I knew about. So I went after that person like a heat-seeking missile. And those of you who know me know I can do that. I can become a heat-seeking missile. And I sought that person out because of what they said. You never have to feel this way again. And they talked about being recovered. Recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. In the foreword of the first edition, it says to show you precisely, not kinda, precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. That's a pretty heavy statement. Says it's a textbook. What's a textbook do? You study it, right? It's not a like read through it quick and go, I got that down. Every time I go through it, I see new stuff. And I found somebody who knew about that. I remember in one of our early visits, he talked about being recovered. I thought he was arrogant. He thought he was recovered. I thought he was arrogant. And telling me he was recovered. I said, what do you mean you're recovered? He said, well, I am. I said, well, how do you know that? He said, because I know I am. I said, well, how do you get recovered? He said, we do what's in here. And I said, well, I've done that. Am I recovered? He said, well, I don't know. I said, well, how will I know when I am? He said, when you are. If you're lucky, you'll have a sponsor like mine. It's the truth. And I got it. I figured it out when I got recovered. If you're in recovery, you must be very tired. Okay? There's a promise that we get to be recovered from this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Okay, we've talked about the body part, putting that alcohol in, you know, and it kicks in and you want to drink a lot. What's the mental part? How am I mentally different? I'm mentally different because I think next time it's going to be different. I wake up in the morning stinking of alcohol, sometimes not even really sure where I am. Have you ever peeked out a window and gone, okay, what street is this? Okay? Feeling horrible. And what do I say? I will never do this again. Ever. And I mean it with every fiber of my being, just like I meant I'll be home at 7. I mean it. Who would ever want to feel like this, stink like this, be frightened of where you've been? Does your car have a bump on it? Who would want to behave like that? I just went for happy hour. I will never do this again. And then the weirdest thing happens. It's the weirdest thing. It could happen 2 hours later, 5 hours later, a day later, 3 days later. It could happen a month later. My mind changes. And I forget why I was never going to do that again. It never even enters my mind. I'm one of those that doesn't even think. See, some people go, oh, well, you know, if I just drink beer instead of wine, or if I, you know, it'll be different. Well, if that isn't pure insanity, what is? I have years of drinking history to show me what's going to happen, and I drink anyway. I have all those experiences behind me, and I can't even bring them into my consciousness to remind me not to drink. I can't just say no. Something's wrong with that mind. That mind needs to be changed. It needs to be fixed. So we're bodily and mentally different. And our loved ones look at us and go, why are you doing this? I don't know. That's why one alcoholic can best help another alcoholic. Isn't it horrible to sit with someone who doesn't have our problem? Try to talk about it? Well, honey, just don't do that. Okay. Well, honey, didn't you understand you had a business meeting? Uh-huh. Well, honey, don't you realize the rent's due? Oh, you know? We're talking apples and oranges. We live in different worlds. But boy, you set one alcoholic down with another and talk about going to that bar for happy hour, and next thing you know, it's, you know, you're in Vegas 3 days later. We understand that. And that's why this thing is so confusing. So the mind has to change. This is what I believe. You ready? Oh, we've got lots of time. This is my experience. I am powerless over alcohol. You see, I can't predict what's going to happen. I can't stop or moderate once I've started. All right, I got that physical thing. And my life's unmanageable. And you want to know what's unmanageable? This little baby right here. This is what's unmanageable. I always thought it was everything out here I wasn't managing well. It's my mind. It's my perception. It's how I view life has got to change. See, I got a mind that tells me the next drink is going to be different. It tells me that it's going to be a completely different experience, or it doesn't tell me anything at all. That's insanity. That's unmanageability to me. And I'm going to say something else. We talk a lot. We got a lot of information these days about, I loved it when Jack was talking about we didn't have dysfunctional households in, you know. And it was like, I came from a war zone. I mean, my mom, God love her, I loved her, I still love her. I just loved her. She just suffered so deeply, you know, and today I understand that. I'm 3 years older than my mother was when she died. And, you know, yeah, I tried menopause on, you know. I understand why she drank. It's like, rah, yeah, you know, but anyway. It's like, you know, like, we lived in this really neat old house. It's actually on the historic register in Texas, and it was a wonderful old house, but it was heated by radiators. Not that we're supposed to be talking about all this, but it's a great story. So anyway, she'd have her hot flashes, and she'd get up in the middle of the night and shut the heat off. Okay, if you've ever lived in an old house with radiators, you know how long it takes to heat the house after they're, like, freezing cold. You know, we'd, like, sit on them and put our clothes on it and, you know, to try and warm up. She just shut off the whole system. But anyway, I get wandering, you know. So I was talking about unmanageability. We'll move back. God will bring us back there. I will tell you another story, though. One of my great fears being up here is that one day God's not going to give me anything to say, if you can imagine that. And it happened at the Lone Star Roundup in Texas. Oh, my God. I got up to give a talk on a Saturday night, and it was really weird. It was the weirdest feeling in the whole world. I was giving this talk, and I felt like I was just going, oh, and this is, you know, and I took amphetamines, and I just heard myself droning, you know, and I just felt like I am so sick of my story. And I looked down, and the voice of the conference looked like he was sleeping, kind of nodding. And I looked out in the audience, and I thought, 2,216 people are sleeping. All right? I was convinced. And I couldn't speak anymore. It was the greatest thing. It was so weird. And I just stopped dead in my tracks. So I have been through my worst fear up here. It did survive, but it's a strange feeling when you think the entire audience is nodding at your story. So anyway, I was back on unmanageability. God will bring us around. I'm going to talk about the insanity of the second step. Okay? The insanity is thinking the next drink's going to be different. So I got this messed up mind, and it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore sanity. My sponsor told me, for the sake of argument, you were insane the second you were born. Okay? We're not going to argue about that. But the insanity, and he knows me well, but the insanity, too, that I talk about is the insanity behind alcoholism, talking about that mental obsession. My mind must change. It has got to be fixed. And you know what stands between me and the next drink because my mind is fixed? God. I don't beat around the bush about it. I'm not going to kid you about it. Bobby said it last night. Don't beat around the bush about the spiritual aspects of this program. And I used to do that early on, talking with people. You know, I would go, well, we do this stuff, and we work these steps, and you have to do this in meetings and all this. And there's a God. Because you don't want to scare them, right? Well, now I just scare them to death. All right? Because the truth is, if I had the power not to drink, I would do that. It is painfully clear to me that I don't have that power. If you don't know that yet, you're probably going to drink again. That's just fact. And nobody can give you your first step. Nobody. Alcohol gave me my first step. It beat me to death. Okay? I got it. I understand what powerlessness is. Nobody can sit down and give that to you. Even though alcohol gave me physically my first step, a good sponsor explained to me later what had happened. And it was in that book. I do not have any power over alcohol. And it's insane to think that the next drink is going to be different. So I need a change of mind. This is my belief. That's what this entire program is about. That's what the book says. In the chapter to We Agnostics, it says, lack of power, that's our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, but exactly how are we going to do that? It says, you know what? That's exactly what this book is about. To enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. How much more clear can you be? That is the whole entire purpose of that book, is to help you find that power that's going to solve the problem. Well, how do you do that? Well, you got to work the steps. See? You got to do the spiritual exercises that are there in order to have that experience. And God gave it back to me, the story I was going to tell you. I was raised, as I told you, in a war zone. It was not pretty. Mama taking Secinols, and, you know, I'd come home from a date, and she was dead on the floor. We'd be pumping her stomach. Thank God my father was a doctor. You know, stitching her up in the middle of the night. I mean, it was crazy, and there was abuse in my household. There was all that stuff. But you want to know something? That did not make me an alcoholic. That is not what makes me an alcoholic. Let's talk. I may have had a next-door neighbor whose mom did all that stuff and had all those deaths and went through all that stuff. And she takes a drink of alcohol, but the phenomenon of craving doesn't kick in. See? So my past is not what makes me an alcoholic, but drinking alcohol relieved the pain of it. It gave me ease and comfort. But even if I hadn't had all that stuff, I still have that thing in me. So when you hear people up here talking about all of their consequences and you didn't have those consequences, that doesn't mean you're not a drunk. Okay? Because I didn't go to jail. I didn't have all that stuff. And I would listen sometimes and I would go, oh, maybe I have some more drinking to do. Everybody has their own journey with it. It's about what happens when I put alcohol in my body and can I stop and moderate or not, and can I not pick up the first drink when I don't want to. The thing that stands between me and the first drink, I said it before, is God. And it doesn't stand before me picking up the drink, because you pick up the drink, it's too late. It's over. I have to have something that stands in between me and the thought of picking up the next drink. It talks about no effective mental defense. All the information I've got about alcoholism, and I got a ton, will not stop me from picking up a drink if I am not spiritually fit. That's a fact. Calling you, people say, oh, well, if you just called me. People call me and say, Janice, I'm going to drink. I say, see you, be careful. You know what I mean? I went through a crisis not too long ago, lasted many years. But I remember I said, called somebody and I said, I'm thinking a drink sounds good. And he said, where are you going to go? And I have very compassionate friends. I said, the College Inn, I've been thinking about going to College Inn. And he goes, oh, God, I used to drink there. He said, that's a really neat place. You know? If you're going to drink, you're going to drink. And that's not unkind. No human power can relieve my alcoholism. If you have the kind of alcoholism I have, you have been placed beyond human aid. The book says so. The book's either right or it's not. I have this theory about Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you ready? Some of you aren't going to like it. I love this. And you can come up and see me after. Tell me what you think of me. I love that stuff. And it says this is a suggested program. Have you ever had a sponsoree look at you and say, well, you can't tell me what to do. These are just suggestions. He was like, no. This is how I view this as a suggested program thing. It's my personal opinion, and it has changed through the years, so it might change again. It says it's a suggested program, which tells me there are some other suggested programs. Let's say there's five of them. There's psychiatry, religion, AA, whatever. Two whatevers. I really wasn't meaning to be funny. I was trying to come up with something, you know, that, because guess what? We do not have a corner on the market. People do get sober without us, by the way. Let's not be arrogant. So it's like, let's say there are these five out there. Maybe I need to start saying three. But anyway, there are these five out there, and you look at that, and you end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Once you come here and decide to do this, there isn't a suggestion in the book. Okay? It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It says, half measures availed us what? Nothing. Not half, not a quarter, not you'll slide by, zippo. Now that to me is not a suggestion. It says if you don't do precisely what's in this book the way it says, you're probably going to get drunk. And it'll tell you lots of places in there where you do get drunk. It'll tell you an inventory. When harboring such feelings, what feelings? Oh, I can't stand that guy. I'd like to run him over with a truck. Those kind of feelings, you know, fear, stuff. We shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we're sure to drink again. Now, is that a suggestion? That's as clear as a bell and has a period at the end of it. In the fifth step, if we don't divulge everything to another human being, if we skip this vital step, we're sure to drink again. I'll be darned. Sex inventory. If we continue to participate in behavior that harms others, we're going to drink again. And if you don't believe it, you better take that one to the bank. I mean it. Our relationship stuff and sobriety is a tough deal, and I know because I've been there. I have. That's a tough deal. And it can separate us from God. But behavior that continues to harm others. There's another one in there. Remember the story of Jim? He failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And there's a line in there that says, if we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, we will not survive the tough times ahead. Period. Now, those are not suggestions. That does not say you might get by with it. You know, and it doesn't say, okay, we've got these 12 steps, and they're in numerical order for boneheads. And, you know, we got them like 1, 2, 3, 4. And these are not new spiritual ideas. There are plenty of religions been doing what we've been doing since time began. But we need them in numerical order so we can follow directions. But nowhere in that book did I see that it said, do the even numbers next Thursday. If the ninth step becomes a little uncomfortable, just don't quit. Just don't do it. You know? Don't do that tough one. And whatever you do, don't be a service. And 12, practicing these principles in all our affairs. Well, affairs don't mean sexual affairs. You know what I mean? So it doesn't say that. It says this is what you got to do. And the neat part is it'll tell you what you'll get if you do it. And it also tells you what you won't get if you don't do it. So I love that book, and I study it. So the second step, restore us to sanity. Sanity means I need a new mind. And I do get restored to sanity. You know where? In the 10th step. In the 10th step, it says, by now, sanity will have returned. I'll seldom be interested in liquor. I'm going to recoil from it like from a hot flame. I'll be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protective. And it just comes. It's just like that. That's sanity. That means the insanity of alcohol is gone. Do you know how far it is between 2 and 10? That's a long haul. Okay? So when you do that 1, 2, 3 thing and quit, you're not going to feel very good after a while. You know? I know because I did that. Between 2 and 10, there's a lot of work we got to do to get that. Now, that may come for you before the first step when you got in, or in the second, or in the fifth, or the seventh, or in the middle of the amends. But for sure, by the 10th step, we're guaranteed of that. And if I don't have that, then I'm missing something. And that's how I'm going to know when I'm recovered. My sponsor tells me to this day, if I'm not a bit evangelical by the middle of the 9th step, we miss something. You know, because I'm on fire again. I've had a new experience. I've written lots of inventories. I come from the school of thought that when I sponsor people, if you're working the steps and I'm taking you through, I'm going through them with you. It's not like I'm sitting here like laying my stuff on you about how spiritual I am and praying with you so you have a rocket fuel experience. I'm taking a third step with you. So that must mean it's time for me to write inventory. Because I answer questions about alcoholism while we talk in the first step. We go over the doctor's opinion. I talk to you about my insanity. I answer the questions in the second step. Don't you love the second step when it says, Well, did we want to live by spiritual principles or go on to the bitter end, blotting out the misery of our intolerable situation? Don't you love that? Alcoholics go, let me think about it. Right? Do I have a few days on that one? You have a fatal disease and I got a way out of it. Yeah, but I'm still having a little bit of fun. I forgot I went to jail. You know? Isn't God fun? Is this the Sunday morning you expected? Anyway, so I've written a lot of inventories. I don't believe in write it once and you're done. Some stuff didn't even come to mind until 5 years later. First 5 years of my sobriety, I felt like I was in a blackout. Seriously, I was a very sick girl. I drank a ton of alcohol. You know, and I came to at my fifth birthday. There was a cake and all these people. I was like, wow, it must have been fun, you know. That's really what it felt like. And I've kind of had memories since then. But, yeah, there's a long haul here. How can I say, well, I wrote this inventory at 2 years sobriety and I'm done? I live in 10, 11, and 12. Well, I think that sounds good in theory, unless you've had the kind of mind that I've had. And the kind of people I deal with, you know, a little house cleaning every once in a while is not bad for the soul. And but don't let me suggest how you do it. It's just how I do it. And I stay active in sponsorship and all that sort of stuff. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about sobriety. You want to hear a little bit about sobriety? Mm-hmm. Some of it's been a kick in the pants. And some of it has just been absolutely terrifying. You know, I mean, what do? You wake up in this world. I came from a war zone. I have absolutely no social skills. I'm glib, which won't get you anywhere with a nickel, and in the real world. But and I wake up without alcohol, and I'm trying to function. Isn't that neat? There's this assumption that we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, we start doing this, and we're well. So we walk around trying to act well, whatever that is. We didn't even grow up in a well place, most of us. So we're trying to act like something we don't even know what it is. You know, and so we have try to have relationships and, you know, oh my God. And I am sort of a humorous story in Denver because I've lived my sobriety right out there. God doesn't let me do it quietly in the basement. And they always go, oh, that's Janice. She's crazy. You know, and but let's talk about relationships maybe. Aren't they fun? Mm. You know, and I've had a few of those. And as a matter of fact, I just love my new pearls. Do you like my pearls? These are freshwater pearls. I'm just so excited. I got them from Christmas from my ex-husband. And we had to get a divorce to figure out how to talk to each other. That's the truth. We're the best of friends today. We were married a few years ago, and we woke up and went, oh, my God, what have we done? And so we got a divorce, and now we're just the best of buddies. And he bought me these beautiful pearls, you know, and we're good friends. And I was in an abusive relationship in sobriety. I don't remember doing that when I was drinking. But I don't. I don't remember anybody behaving like that. And I was pretty mean when I drank, so they probably wouldn't. But anyway, I got hooked up with this guy, and I was with him for 5 years. And it was ugly. It was pretty scary. And he wasn't the only one who was abusive. I got in touch with a little bit of my anger at about 7 years. And women are always taught not to be angry and not do that. We are seething cauldrons of violence. all right, we're so sweet and we're so polite. And it's like, you know, I'll wrap you up in the bed sheet and beat you to death with a baseball bat in a heartbeat. A woman was acquitted of murder because of PMS, okay, in England. And I remember when I heard that, I'm like, yes, I'm home free. And that's in sobriety. But I have no place to hide from these feelings. And my anger was so well hidden that it stayed away for like 6 years, 7 years. And when it came out, baby, I'm going to tell you what, stuff started flying. I owned my house, and I started throwing stuff. I mean, I threw anything I could get my hands on. And this guy had a big fish tank there. And I remember once I picked up a big leaded crystal candle holder. I picked that baby up behind my arm. And I remember him looking at the fish tank and thinking about it, and then covering his head instead. So he decided to... But it was a wild relationship. It was frightening, and I got hurt physically. And I would write inventory about it. See, I like to talk about practical application sobriety. I would write inventory, and I would take it to my sponsor, and he would listen. And I'd write some more inventory and take it to my sponsor, and he'd listen. And one day I took him some inventory, and he said, aren't you sick about writing about this? And I looked at him, he said, because I'm really sick of listening to it. And in my mind, I thought, well, that's your damn job. Right? He's listening to my inventory. And then I got it. See, I wasn't being healed. It wasn't gone. I wanted out of that relationship, and I couldn't figure out how I couldn't leave. I couldn't figure out why I continued to put myself in a place of harm and why I couldn't get out of it. And then one day I'm driving down the street and driving down the freeway, and I remember I'm coming up on University Boulevard North because there's a loop. See, I had a spiritual experience, and that's how I know that that's when it happened. And I was praying to God because I knew my life was at stake. And I'm going around the country giving talks, okay, and going home to this crazy household. And sponsoring people and acting spiritual and, you know, trying to be normal. And it's violent. And I'm thinking, how do you tell people that that's what's going on here? You know, we don't talk about that in AA. People don't talk about that stuff. You know, and I'm driving up this ramp and I'm begging God, what do I do? How do I get out of this? Why can't I leave? And I heard the voice. And the voice said, because you're beyond human aid. I did not have the power to leave. And I got it. And I went home and I wrote inventory like my heart depended on it. My life depended on it, because it did. And I knew then that I needed a new attitude and a new relationship with my Creator, because of my own power, I couldn't leave. And I went home and I wrote that and I took it to my sponsor and he listened, because he knew that there was a difference. We can work steps to try to manage our lives, or we can work steps to have an experience with the Creator. See, people get stuck in the steps thinking, oh, I'm doing all this work. Well, don't bother, if depending on what your motives are. Because it's not to manage our lives, to fix our relationships, to bring us money or anything. So I fist-stepped this stuff with him, and within about 60 days, that relationship was over. There was no arguing, there was nothing. It was done. Because I knew that my priorities were out of whack, and I knew that I had moved God out of my life. And because I know that the steps give me that new attitude and new relationship that it talks about in the fifth step that's critical, that's what I got. And I got the power to go. It may sound like a crazy story, but I know there are people out there right now that are living in relationships they don't want to talk to people about. And we do things that we don't want to hear about. You know, and you're sitting there thinking, you know, if I told somebody this, they think I was crazy. Or people in AA don't do that because they just act like, you know, they get sober and then everything's great. So I must be doing something wrong. See, I find it amusing to some degree. It's a spiritual meeting. Because you see, we don't have spiritual parts in our lives. We have adopted a spiritual way of living. It's not like there's a spiritual part when we go to meetings and we go home and beat our husband or with a baseball bat. You know? Or get on the freeway. You want to gauge your spiritual well-being? Oh, baby. No offense. Those Californians on Colorado roads, I got to tell you, we're ready to kill them. You know, I saw a bumper sticker the other day that says, please go back to California and take a Texan with you when you go. So we're having growing pains. You know, people shoot each other on the freeway, right? We got that stuff going on. How is your mental health on the freeway? That's where spiritual practices aren't about just AA meetings. That's easy. We listen to the same caca over and over from our friends, you know, how we do this, how we do that. What a great sponsor I am. I'm working the steps, and you get in the car and you become a lethal weapon. Okay? I'm talking about practical application. That's where it is. It's in our homes. It's in our workplace. I brought up the topic of tolerance the other day in a meeting. I'll tell you how it came about. It just came to me. God gave me a message about tolerance, and I thought, I get messages. You should get messages too. Don't ever tell that to a psychiatrist. Don't do it. The stuff we talk about, they don't get it. And love and tolerance. And so I was talking to my ex about it, and at first he went, well, that's a really dumb topic. I was like, well, thanks for your support, big boy. And then he went, God, what a great topic, because I never hear it in meetings. So I said, well, I know a couple places where it's there, love and tolerance of others, etc. I said, where is exactly in the book, being the book queen? And then he had one of those study guide books, you know, that have the index in the back. And I thought, let's look it up. So I thought, let's look up love. Well, there were far too many entries for love. That would have taken too long. So I went to tolerance. And there were 10 entries for tolerance in the first 131 pages. And when I looked it up in the dictionary, see, I thought it had to do with putting up with you people. Okay? Endurance. I'm like the long-haul endurer putting up with the world, okay? And I thought I was noble doing it. Tolerance is the capacity to allow others to have their own experience. That's what it is. Look it up. It's a great definition, the first definition. So I chaired on it at the meeting. You would have thought that I said your next spouse ought to be a donkey. Okay? I mean, it really got people going. Yeah, okay? And so I'm into, and thinking about this spiritual meeting and this sort of stuff, I'm into tolerance these days. See, I'm a big book thumping queen, and the last inventory I went through had to do with me being the AA police. I am the AA police, and I carry a very big stick. And if you're not an alcoholic, I think you're taking up space in the meeting, you need to get out, okay? So I get all freaked out if I got alcoholics in the meeting, or non-alcoholics in an AA meeting, okay? And I don't want you talking to an alcoholic, because I think you can kill him, see, because there's no God going to take care of it. And so I'm the AA police. And if you're not working the steps right, I'm going to let you know that too. And I will visit with other people as to whether or not you are an alcoholic. How do you like that? I am a wonderful, non-judgmental, tolerant kind of human being. I got this thing. I'm worried non-alcoholics, I mean, they could kill us. You know? So I do this inventory, and I'm reading it to my sponsor, and oh, I'm so embarrassed. I mean, isn't it horrible? Because I so respect this person. And I look up and go, oh, man, isn't this disgusting? And he goes, yeah. He said, do you want to know what it is? And I said, what? He said, it's arrogant. You're arrogant. I mean, they're never nice to me. I need it. Arrogance. So I'm learning about tolerance, and the truth is really none of my business what you are. And it's only my business to explain to you how to write inventory if you've asked me to take you through the steps. You know what I mean? I don't need to look at you in a meeting and go, boy, you are a bonehead. And if you don't do it the way I think you ought to do it, you're going to get drunk. Don't you love people come up to you and say, you're going to get drunk? Well, how do you know that? No? I also got very, very sick. I got to tell you this. I may go over a couple minutes. At 15 years of sobriety, I had it going on. I bought a house when I was 6 years sober. I've always had very high-paying jobs. I make good money. I did. I don't make anything now. Anyway, which has been what the story's about. But I just had it going on. I had money in the bank. I had a pension plan. I had friends that I'd stayed with me. I put on big parties. I took good care of people. I sponsored like a demon. Traveled around the country. I was God's soldier, and it was showing, right? And all of a sudden, one day I woke up, and I had this lump in my breast. It was about the size of a grape, which on my breast you notice. And so, can you believe I just said that? I never tell a lie. So anyway. So anyway, I had a little breast cancer scare. I came through that, you know what I mean? And I don't believe in surgery and stuff. I've got these weird ideas. But anyway, so I came through that. It was a terrifying experience. Then I get pregnant. I'm 45 years old, which was like a miracle from the Creator. You know, at 45, I did it the regular way. It wasn't artificial insemination, you know? So the doctor was like really excited, like, wow, she did it the regular way. She's 45. This is a good thing. And I was healthy. Everything was great. And then one day I went in for an ultrasound. I had the father with me, and there was no heartbeat. And I just passed a bunch of tests. And they're all sitting there staring at the machine, and they wouldn't look at me, right? And I'm like, what are you doing? And they're just looking, and they're looking at each other, you know, and they didn't want to tell me. I said, you better get straight with me, girl. You know what I mean? And so they told me. There was no heartbeat. I'd lost the baby. And I don't have any children, and I wanted that baby more than anything else in the whole world. And one of the reasons I wanted it was I thought it was a payoff for 15 years of good behavior in this horrible place. Okay? Not that it was always horrible, but you know what I mean? Those of us that are out there doing the trudge and doing the deal, sometimes it is not fun. And I thought, I got the big payoff for being such a good girl, and then it was gone in a nanosecond. Next thing that happened was all these conventions, I was a convention planner, I had on the books canceled. My entire salary for the year was gone. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I lost the ability to earn a living. It was remarkable. I couldn't make a dime if my life depended on it. And I came from years, since the age of 18, everything I touched turned to gold. And I started thinking, boy, you cannot be very spiritual if this is what's happening to you. And I started hearing this really weird voice in my head saying things like, what did you expect? How did you think life was going to turn out? And I'm thinking that's the voice of the God I had at 15 years. This happens to people like you. You expected something better? This is in my head. And I went, uh-oh, I'm in deep trouble. And I'm watching my life spin out of control. I spent investments so I could pay off my debt. Next thing I know, I'm spending some more, and because I keep thinking I'm going to pull a rabbit out of the hat. It's going to work, you know, and I had to live, and next thing I know, I got to sell my house that I was so proud of so I could pay off some more debt and continue to support myself, because no matter what I touched, it turned to garbage. And I remember how angry I was at God. I said, I have been one of your biggest warriors. How dare you treat me this way? What is your problem? Why did I even bother? And I didn't. All these nice things I thought I'd just done for people out of the kindness of my heart, I had them on a list in my head. Don't you remember I lent that guy $500 and I took so-and-so in, and what about the time I did this and that? I'm like bargaining with the Creator, right, to change my life. And I'm angry. And then I got it. That the God I had in my life at that moment was not sufficient to the task to help me in that strange mental blank spot. And I found out that that voice was the voice of my father and not God. And I'd been writing inventory on my dad for 15 years and couldn't get rid of him. So I went through the steps again. I did not go through the steps to cure my financial situation. I did not go through the steps to get pregnant or to clear up the breast stuff. I knew that my relationship with God was suffering because I've been hanging out here enough and working steps enough and had enough experiences here to know that that was the truth. And I needed a new God or I wasn't going to make it. So I went through the steps to get that new attitude, new relationship with the Creator, and I got it. And it's taken me 5 or 6 years to start coming through this stuff, you guys. And it was very ugly. I lost everything. I live in a garden level, which is downstairs, two-bedroom apartment, old apartment. I drive an 87 VW Fox today. And I used to be able to just write a check for anything. That may sound horrible to you, but it's not. While I was in it, I was suicidal. I wanted to slip my wrists. And what I found out was all this faith that I thought I had in God, I didn't. I had faith in money, property, and prestige. I had faith in the equity in my house. I had faith in my IRA. I had faith in my ability to earn a living, no matter what was going on. And I didn't know it. You know what I got today? You know what God, what I got through all this? I'm not saying God did it to me. Knock that off, okay? But what happened was, by this process, I got a center. And the center is mine. It's God. No matter what's going on. Now, if you haven't had some of those experiences here, you're missing out. The power of this program is so phenomenal of what's available. Does it promise us riches and goods and... No. You know what it promises me? I went through stuff that would make your hair stand on end. And I didn't take a drink. I did not drink alcohol. I didn't think about drinking alcohol except that time I wanted to go to the college bar. And they said, go ahead. And I thought, well, that's not a good idea. You know, but I truly have a relationship with my Creator. And all that stuff had to get out of the way. And I'm actually grateful for it. My priorities are in order. I feel pretty good. I own a business and it was a little bit better this holiday season. And I'm gaining, but I have this sense that everything's going to be okay. I never had that. I had to have more and more and more and more in sobriety. Why do we work steps over and over? It's because, see, usually we come in here with nothing, all right? So it's easy to surrender, right? Yeah, let's surrender. Aha, my paper bag and a toothbrush. Right? My bus pass. But you get some time in here, and you start collecting stuff, lovers, money, this, that, whatever, a house. Talk about turning it all into the Creator of light who presides over us all. You're talking about a different ballgame. So, the spiritual meeting. It says we practice these principles in all of our affairs, these spiritual principles. What are spiritual principles? I used to think, oh, they mean we write inventory a lot. Spiritual principles, concepts. Gratitude, joy, chastity, unselfishness, love, kindness, charity. The list is endless, isn't it? Integrity. I learned some new words here that I didn't have before. Those are spiritual principles, and I believe this too, that we talk about gratitude. You go to a gratitude meeting and you think you're supposed to have that warm, snuggly feeling and you don't. I used to hate gratitude meetings when I was in that place. Let's talk about gratitude. I'm like, well, how about I hit you in the head with a book? I'm just so grateful, you know, and I'm thinking, I don't know how I'm going to eat tomorrow. What do you mean you're grateful? But see, I believe this is an action program. I believe gratitude is an action word. We show our gratitude. You think you want to sit around and feel warm and snuggly? Well, go home and feel warm and snuggly. That's not how mine works. My gratitude shows when I get up, even when I don't feel good, and go do something in the middle of my stuff, because that's what I'm taught to do here, because we carry the message that way. Because if I fail to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, I'm not going to survive the tough times ahead. Love is not a feeling. So when that feeling that we think is love goes away, I get a divorce, right? Love is an action word. Love is how we treat people. Faith is not a feeling. If I sit around and wait for faith to come, you know, I don't get out the door. I won't go on a sales call if I'm waiting for faith to come. Faith is action. Faith is stepping out and doing it anyway. It's the do it anyway word. And I believe that. You know, people want to sit around and feel good. I think we need to work our butts off instead. You know, because I've been a self-centered. My disease is self. My disease is me, thinking I'm the most important thing in the whole world. Whereas close to a bunch of narcissistic listed people in the, what's that, MSD 528 or whatever those psychiatrists have? You know what I mean? They look at us coming on, they're like, yes, you know? Because all I think about is me. When I think about somebody else, I've had a spiritual experience. Seriously. That's why the book says over and over and over, the constant thought of others has got to be our guiding force. If you've not had the experience of thinking of someone else in the middle of your stuff and your stuff going away, you have missed out. You don't know what's available here. Well, I'm not going to tell my corn story because you guys are from Kansas. And we're over the hour, but it's like, I have a good life today. It's a different life today. I'm sober today. My sobriety date is May 3rd of 1981. I'm grateful for every moment of it. Some of it's tough. And I guess my point here is, if you're having a tough time in sobriety, you better go tell somebody because it can kill you. And if you have a sponsor that you cannot tell your take it to the grave stuff to, you get rid of them today and get another one. Because our lives depend on, and I believe that. And if the sponsor gets offended, then you needed to change sponsors. See, I don't get offended when people fire me. I'm like, great, it just gives me more free time for Oreos, okay? And so, you know, I'm into vanilla chocolate chip ice cream. But, is that a scream? I've just loved being here, and your courtesy and hospitality is par none. I mean that. I travel a little bit. I'm not like a circuit speaker thing, but I travel, and you all are as gracious and kind a group as I've been with, and I thank you, and God bless each and every one of you on your journey.